Pondering Silence. Some people seek silence and solitude, perhaps retreating to the deep woods or a main island for a week or longer. Some traveling to a special place. Throughout history, monks from both Western and Eastern traditions have devoted themselves to silence. And in the past couple centuries, prisoners have increasingly been placed in solitary confinement. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine author Jane Brocks has long been interested in the meaning of silence, why it's pursued, and how it changes people. Her new book is Silence, A Social History of One of the Least Understood Elements in Our Lives. Brocks is our guest today. What is your relationship with silence? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In our busy, always on-the-go lives, we often don't have time for moments of silence. But silence can be all around us, and the use of silence for good and for punishment is part of a new book by Jane Brocks. Jane is the author of a number of books, including Brilliant, The Evolution of Artificial Light, and Clearing Land, Legacies of the American Farm. She is a Mainer and joins me in the studio to talk about her new book, Silence, A Social History of One of the Least Understood Elements of Our Lives. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you think about when you think about silence? Is it comforting? Does it provoke anxiety? Do you crave silence? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And welcome, Jane. Congratulations. I really enjoyed reading Silence, this book. I was telling Jane before the program that I was reading it on my couch, but I had my phone next to me, and there's a jackhammer going off outside the window, so it wasn't exactly silent. And there's also some irony in talking about this on a radio show, because as you might suspect, silence is rarely a good thing in radio. It usually means something went wrong.
Exactly.
Oh, my That's goodness. Right. But why don't I just start by asking you how you began to be interested in the whole concept of silence?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I think, well, this book, in fact, had two steps, maybe. I think way back to my early 20s when I was first starting to write. And silence and solitude are essential for a writing life, although I hardly knew that then when I was starting out. So I lived on this far side of Nantucket one winter, and that's when I first encountered silence. The enormity of silence, I would say, was there, and fought with it and loved it and hated it over a winter on the island. And then in 2001, I visited a monastery in the south of France, and that really, it was there that I thought, I want to write about this in a larger way. But it wasn't until much later that I ended up settling on writing about it. But just the visit to the monastery and seeing those rooms built for silence, communal silence, really had a profound effect on me, I think.
When you think about silence, when you think about silence and write about it, what do you mean by silence? Do you mean the absence of all noise, or do you mean the absence of people talking, or the absence of maybe people talking and hearing a machine in the background?
Well, it's interesting. I think of silence, there's no such thing as an absolute silence. There's no such thing as the absence of noise. John Cage once went into a chamber where there was supposed to be no sound, but he claimed to be able to hear his heart beating and, you know, the blood moving through his veins. And in our modern world, John Cage is another person who said, you know, the sound of silence in our time is the sound of traffic, you know, the distant sound of traffic. It's really more a state of concentration, a state of mind, than anything absolute, I would say.
And what I've learned from reading your book is that silence is not simple.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I think of it as, and it's changeable. I mean, it changes from minute to minute, from hour to hour. Your patience with it, your impatience with it, all at the same time sometimes. So,
one of the many things you discuss is when somebody has an experience in which they've whether it's been imposed upon them or whether they've sought it out themselves, when they've been in silence or in solitude for an extended period of time and then they come out of that, how difficult it is to emerge into the real world. And I'm wondering, was that like that for you and that experience you had when you were younger and you spent a winter, you know, in a very, very, very quiet place?
It was. And I remember very well after that winter, I moved up to Watertown, Massachusetts, and I couldn't bear it. You know, I couldn't, and it was the sound, the noise I couldn't bear, really. And gradually over time, I got used to it, but it took a long time, especially during a snowstorm. I missed the quiet of a snowstorm. You know, the minute before the snow fell, the snowplows were on before the snow finished falling, the snowplows were on the street. People were out shoveling, and I missed just the utter and extended quiet of a snowstorm. I remember that so well.
It's interesting because throughout this book, you weave kind of two different ideas about silence and solitude. And one is the life of monks, mm-hmm. and people who seek silence for a spiritual reason. But then also you talk a lot about prisons and, mm-hmm. and the idea of what's come to be called solitary confinement. And it's really interesting, this idea of solitary confinement and how you explore how this came to be part of our prison system. So tell us about that a little bit. Tell us about Benjamin Rush and how it is that we have this concept in our country.
Well, the idea of solitary confinement, I think the way Benjamin Rush imagined it in the late 18th century, in his world, punishment was still hanging and branding, very public. And it was instantaneous. There was no such thing as being confined in a jail for an extended period as punishment. Jails were temporary places where people were awaiting trial. But he, in the late 18th century, the country itself was looking for a way to distinguish itself from Europe, looking for a way to distinguish its justice system from the traditional justice system. And Benjamin Rush developed the idea of a penitentiary where each prisoner would be confined in a cell and sentenced to silence in that cell. And in that cell, he would read or and contemplate his life and come to redemption over time. So it was replacing bodily punishment with time. And it took 30, 40 years before the Eastern State Penitentiary became a reality. And in fact, Benjamin Rush died before it became a reality. But that was the first use of silence and solitude as punishment in the country.
Of course, some of his ideas that someone would come out transformed and so much better able to exist in the world were all wrong in retrospect.
Correct. I mean, he based his idea on the concept of monastic silence, but he failed to comprehend just how much community there is in a monastery and how the monks lived together, prayed together, worked together to function, to make the monastery function and help each other live. In the penitentiary, every soul was isolated from every other soul, and that was intentional. And they couldn't talk to each other. They weren't to know who their neighbors were or how many people were in the penitentiary or where they were in the penitentiary. It was utter disorientation to the greater world.
What do we know about how people fared who went into this penitentiary, who spent 2 years or longer in enforced solitude and silence? How did they fare after they got out?
Not very well. I mean, a lot of them may have had problems going in, and that certainly didn't help them to be condemned to silence and solitude. A lot of people, and when they returned to the world, they were totally unprepared. Not only were they in silence and solitude, the world had gone on without them. They had no training or preparation to send them back into the world. So the record isn't good as to how they fared. And a lot of them diminished both physically and mentally while in solitary confinement.
It's interesting because solitary confinement is very much the concept of it's very much in the news and in the public mm-hmm. discussion mm-hmm. right now. Very controversial. But the solitary confinement we think about today really has almost nothing to do with what Benjamin Rush and the other reformers of the 1800s envisioned.
Right. I mean, no judge will sentence anyone to solitary confinement now. Solitary confinement in prison today is punishment within punishment, meted out for prisoners who are deemed to be unable to be in the general population or who've committed crimes while they were in prison or are thought to be too dangerous to be in the general population. And solitary is a very noisy place now. I mean, there's solitary confinement, but there isn't silence. So
let's talk about the other sort of strain that comes through the book, and this is the whole idea of monastic silence. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because I think to so many of us, there's some idealism when you think about, wow, what it must be like to live this peaceful, like you said, quiet but communal life in a beautiful place with spirituality on your mind. But you say there are kind of two sides to the coin.
Well, I don't think any experienced monastic would say that their life is easy. I mean, I think that the conversation monastics have with silence is a continual one. And and in the book, I largely use the example of Thomas Merton because he was so articulate when it came to his own struggles with his own life and with the monastic life. And he also had a very particular monastic life. He was also a famous writer, so that the world was always pulling at him, even in his monastery. But that tension between the world and being removed from the world is so palpable and beautifully articulated in his work that I couldn't find anyone better.
Well, and it's funny because I've marked a couple of the quotes from Thomas Merton in the book, and one is one that he says, "Inner silence depends on continual seeking. If we cling to a silence we think we found forever, we stop seeking God, and the silence goes dead within us." Mm-hmm. That's a lot to think about.
It is. It is. And I think he's right. There's no complacency in silence. Could that be right? I mean, I think that's what he's getting after, is that, you know, it's not a place you arrive to. It's a place that constantly beckons you.
So. And then on the next page, "High up in the late summer sky, I watch the silent flight of a vulture, and the day goes by in prayer. This solitude confirms my call to solitude. The more I am in it, the more I love it. One day it will possess me entirely, and no man will ever see me again."
Yes, Merton had a very, you know, he was besieged by society in a way. People were writing to him constantly. People were, you know, well-known people were coming to the monastery to visit him. A lot was demanded of him by his higher-ups. They wanted him to write for the monastery, so that he was always dreaming of that place of the hermitage, the place that was entirely away from even the monastery. And I think that seeking may have been more important than the realization of it. It was that desire to find the hermitage that was so important to him.
And in both the monastery and in a prison, though, and this is one of the parallels you draw, Jane, is that silence can also be used for power and control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's true. I mean, that is the hallmark of the silence within the penitentiary. Was Benjamin Rush may have had an idealized vision of what it could do, but the people in charge of the prisoners had a very practical consideration, and that they had to keep control and order in the prison, and so they saw it, I think, it more as a way, means of control, and didn't really consider the larger purpose of redemption. And in the monastery, I mean, I think even in everyday life, I question this in my own life, is when I'm seeking silence, am I seeking to control other people's access to me? Am I seeking to, keep people at a distance if I'm seeking my own silence? Is it a means of control to just say that? And I think that's also true in a monastery as well.
Has researching and writing this book changed your relationship with silence or changed your life?
Well, I've been leading a quiet life for a long time as a writer. I live by myself in my own house. I think what it's done is made silence more complicated for me, or I understand it in a much broader way than I did going into the writing of the book, that the book really fleshed out a lot of the intricacies of silence and made me understand that what I'm seeking, made me ask myself what I'm seeking when I'm seeking silence more than I had been before. So it seems much simpler before all this.
Well, and before this book.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? As we look back through centuries, you make a very good point in that, people in past centuries, their lives were much quieter anyway.
Right.
And not just silence as far as sound, but light was different. Mm-hmm. When it got dark at night, it was dark.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't street lights.
Right,
there
weren't right.
the neighbor's windows. And today, there's noise everywhere. And people fill their entire days. I would say most people probably fill their entire days intentionally with mm-hmm. sound. They put on the radio. They're listening right now. Or the television. Or go home and put on some music on their smart speaker. And so it's more difficult to find silence than it ever has been before.
I think that's true. I mean, I was thinking about this in the last months of writing the book, and I came to the conclusion that it's easier to fly to Japan on the other side of the world than to find a few hours of silence in the world. You know, that so many things have made silence will always make way for noise. You have to consciously seek out silence in our world today. It's not going to be a given. And I think because noise will always, come in some way. So I think silence maybe 8 or 9 centuries ago was more of a given. But the interesting thing to me is that people have always sought silence. I mean, the monasteries of the Middle Ages, these people were in a very quiet world, and yet there was something more they wanted. They wanted this greater silence. They wanted to be away from the world itself. So there's something constant about the seeking of silence. I think we feel more anxious about it in our time just because there's so much noise.
Well, we're speaking with Jane Brocks. She is the author of Silence, A Social History of One of the Least Understood Elements of Our Lives. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for efficiency Maine energy audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, an exonerated man takes on the prosecutors who sent him to death row.
I'm speaking in terms of what is a crime? What is attempted murder? If I tell you that this attorney took $10 from me, you're going to try to get it. But I can tell you he tried to kill me. You ain't going to do him nothing.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Saturday afternoon at 2 and Sunday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
One night, many years ago, Abigail Marsh swerved on a busy highway and spun out to a stall.
And I turn and I see a man standing there. And all he said was, "You look like you could use some help." Why would somebody risk their life to help a stranger anonymously? Why would anybody do that?
I'm Guy Raz. Ideas about altruism and what motivates us to help others. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And you can listen to the TED Radio Hour Saturday afternoon at 1 and Wednesday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, thinking about silence. Joining me in the studio, Jane Brocks. She is an author, and her new book is Silence, A Social History of One of the Least Understood Elements of Our Lives. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800 399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On our Facebook page, I asked whether people crave silence, and Amy writes, "The older I get, the more I crave extended periods of silence, especially at the end of a busy day. It's hard on my spouse, who works alone all day and wants to reconnect by chatting when we both get home. Sometimes I just want to cover my ears and say, too many words, too many words."
I can understand that completely.
We'll go to Anne Marie, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, Anne Marie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking
too many
in
words.
Terms of those people who are seeking an opportunity for silence, there is a possibility in Western Massachusetts that what's called the Vipassana Meditation Center, and they offer 10-day silent meditation retreats, which I participated in some years ago, with a lot of apprehension and trepidation, and was curious about those people who had actually been there several times and thought, why would anybody do that? And then several months after coming back, I realized the gift of having been through that.
And have you returned, Anne Marie?
I have not personally returned. It's a big commitment for me to take 10 days away. I take care of my mother frequently.
Would you like to return? Would you like to return?
I would love to return. It was one of the things that I realized coming back was the ability to not take on the stress of other people. I remember a phone call that someone in my family made to me not the day after I got back, and it was a big, long story about a lot of stress and trauma that had happened while I was gone, and it was all over. And I thought, oh, wow, I don't have to take that on. I could feel the ability to just hear it and not take on that stress. And it was an amazing gift. And it was very challenging. It's one of the most challenging things I've ever done. The physical part of it, sitting for up to 14 hours a day in meditation, was probably a bigger challenge than not speaking.
You know, these are common throughout the country, aren't they? Jane, it's not what you write about in your book, but there are many meditation centers where people can go have an enforced silence for a week or 2 weeks at a time.
There are. And monasteries often welcome people on retreat for, you know, anywhere from a few days to a few weeks. And you can go to a monastery and just have time away. So there are possibilities to remove yourself from your life. And in fact, get a greater sense of what silence can be and bring it back to your own life oftentimes.
Anne Marie, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Cumberland and Tig. Hi, Tig. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Happy Friday. So a friend of mine was getting her PhD in music technology and sound engineering a couple of years ago. And when she was researching for her dissertation, she came across kind of some facts around that a baby, the first time that they actually ever experience silence is when it's traveling down the birth canal during birth, because it creates kind of a sound vacuum, versus, you know, when they're in the womb, kind of you hear all of the internal organs chippering away. I thought that was really fascinating, and I just love to hear any thoughts that that Jane has.
Well, that's like John Cage's experience in the anechoic chamber when he heard his own heart and his blood moving through his body. So I guess you can't get away from those sounds, but it's kind of interesting. I wonder if that's what made the baby cry, makes babies cry when they come out.
I know, and I wonder how it affects babies who are born by C-section and never have that moment in the birth control.
Oh, that's true.
Tig, thanks for your call. A tweet from the Maine State Library. In 2013, Pew Trust survey of what people want from public libraries, a place for silence and quiet was second only to access to computers and the internet. I love that.
Yeah.
That sort of speaks to our modern world,
right?
We want computers, we want the internet, but we also want quiet.
Yeah. I was thinking, I don't know when the last time a librarian shushed anyone. I mean, libraries also have become more of a community space. And so they're In Brunswick, there is a part of the library set off for quiet study, but the library in general is no longer entirely quiet.
Many colleges, the college libraries will have different floors with different levels of quiet, and there'll be a super quiet floor, which even sort of unwrapping a piece of candy would be verboten. So we're going to go to Pat calling from Lewiston. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'd like to share the value of a short period of silence as opposed to an extended. I love the extended. I've been on silent retreats. But what I have discovered in the last couple of years is that if I am in my car and I'm driving somewhere, when I arrive, I have discovered that you don't have to get out of the car right away. You can just sit there. You can turn off the engine and sit for 2 minutes or 5 minutes and do nothing but breathe or look at what's outside. And it works the other way. If you're leaving someplace and you get into your car, you don't immediately have to start up the engine. You can sit there for 5 minutes. I've once or twice have had somebody tap on my window and say, "Are you okay?" but it has amazed me how soothing that can be.
Yeah,
and I just want to speak to the value of, you know, grabbing a few minutes of silence where you can.
Yeah, the transitional power of it, the sort of way it can also, you know, finish one encounter and before you start another, you can have this moment of breathing in between.
Correct. Pat, thank you for calling and sharing that. We'll go to Weston, who's calling from Rockland. Hi, Weston. Go ahead.
Yes, sir, good afternoon. I just wanted to mention that there's a story that you can find online about a man named Harold King, who was a missionary in China who spent 5 years in solitary confinement, and he came out of it pretty well adjusted, even being able to give a public address to a large crowd of people not long after he was released. And his secret was that he spoke aloud. And being a missionary, he imagined that he was visiting with people, and he would speak to this person in that corner of the cell, and another person in another corner of the cell, kept him going for nearly 5 years.
Yeah, and you write about how different people handle solitary confinement differently. Some people do much better than others, and there are studies about who succeeds better.
Right. I mean, Eugenia Ginsburg, who was in solitary confinement in the Soviet Union, actually would write poems, and she had poems memorized, and she would continually recite these memorized poems to her. She recalled all the things she'd read over time, so she kept her mind very active. And that's one of the secrets of surviving long periods of solitary confinement, just as Harold King did. And also, the more disciplined a person is, the more regimented they can make their day, the better they seem to be. Because if they can sort of, Ginsburg at one point was put in a dark cell where she couldn't even keep track of day and night. And she, every time she was brought food, she would make a tear in her shirt so she could count the days. And that helped keep her, just give her a sense of sanity. Yes.
We'll go to Margie calling from Jonesboro. Hi, Margie.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great.
Great program as usual.
Thank you.
Well, many years ago, I took lessons from Maharishi Mahesh Yoga. But besides that, I went to Texas once by plane, then over to Florida, and then to back to Maine. And I'll tell you something. If Donald Trump came to my door and said, "Here's $1 million, go to New York and live," I'd say, "You come here and look at the blackberry bushes, the apple trees, walk along my water, and take your money and go back. Because this is peace and silence, and I'm an artist, I do painting and stuff. And to me, just to get in tune with Mother Nature, with the beautiful, even the trees that move, even the water that splashes, anything. And I have a lot of land over here, so let me tell you, Maine is the last frontier, and this is a paradise. And anybody that wants to have some peace and silence, this is where they got to come. They don't have to travel too far. Anyway, that's all.
Margie, thanks for calling.
Thank you, Margie.
I don't think Margie's unusual.
No, she isn't. And there's a beautiful book that was very influential to me while writing Silence called The World of Silence by Max Picard. And he has beautiful descriptions of just the silence of winter and the silence of summer. And he records, you know, the silence of nature has so many beautiful sounds in it. And that's something John Cage also knew. And he brings it to life on the page in a very beautiful way.
Mm-hmm. And famously, Henry David Thoreau,
right,
is somebody right. who's written about or tried.
Yeah,
though he had, as you point out, three chairs in his cabin.
Right. But I think that's important: one for solitude, two for friendship, and three for company.
We'll go to Anne, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Anne. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, Jennifer, thank you, and hello, Jane. This is a lovely program. I was sharing with the person who takes your calls that I grew up in Ireland, and it's interesting that we frequently, probably at least once every term, there were three terms in the year, in boarding school, I'm talking about my secondary school, high school, we would have a retreat, a silent retreat. Well, when you're a teenager, it's very hard not to titter and laugh or pass a note to a friend, all of which were forbidden, of course. But somehow it was good. You know, it was interesting looking back on that experience and then doing it as an adult, like as a mother of young children, and getting away to a silent retreat was very different. And also just doing it, you know, traveling. And silence and fasting are an interesting way to combine this experience mm-hmm. also. And I'm a birder. I love to go to the woods. With Mary Oliver, just her dying last week, I've gone back and pulled out all of her, you know, most of the books that I have of hers, and like her short essays, Upstream. And most of her writing comes from that silence, comes from that mm-hmm. place of nature. And but this is a beautiful program. I'm really happy you're talking about this today.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, something you brought up. I think silence can mean different things at different times of life. You know, not every day. And this is just something I'm thinking off the top of my head. Maybe not every time of life is for silence. There are certain times of life where silence has more meaning than others.
Anne, thank you for your call. An email from Alex. I live alone for long periods in the winter on a deserted group of islands off the coast of New Hampshire and Maine. I've been the winter caretaker for the past 22 years. And silence, to me, can sometimes feel like an actual presence, mm-hmm. a quiet, expansive presence.
That seems to ring true for a lot of people who have lived for long periods of time with extended silence, that it is almost its own entity. Yeah. Doris Grombach felt that in her book, 50 Days of Solitude, when she was in northern Maine, spent 50 days by herself. It was definitely a presence then for her, too.
An email from Diane. One of our dogs has a neurological condition that makes her very sensitive to noise. Even a cough or the start of a quiet conversation will set her barking. It makes one very aware at the amount of noise that interrupts our day. Thank goodness for camp. Quiet abounds. You know, we just absorb so much noise and we don't even think about it, do we?
I think that's probably true. And I think, you know, as modern humans, we've just had to condition ourselves to working through the noise rather than trying to cancel the noise. So it's in a continual balance.
We're talking with author Jane Brox, who just happens to live in Maine. Her new book is Silence, a social history of one of the least understood elements in our lives. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Ocean View at Falmouth, an active retirement living campus proudly supporting Saturday afternoon opera, oceanviewrc.com, and Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Oh, it's been quite a week in the media sphere, from accusation to apology to apoplexy.
They're teenagers, they're wearing Trump hats, And they are Catholics. They believe in Jesus Christ. They are the enemy.
Hot takes, hot mess. Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
You can listen to On the Media tomorrow afternoon at 3 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Silence in Our Lives. Joining me, author Jane Brocks. Some of her previous books are brilliant. The Evolution of Artificial Light, Clearing Land, Legacies of the American Farm, 5,000 Days Like This One, and Here and Nowhere Else. We are discussing her latest book, Silence, A Social History of One of the Least Understood Elements of Our Lives. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Going to Liz, who's calling from Lovell. Hi, Liz. Go ahead.
Hi there. This is an awesome program, and I'm glad I'm having the opportunity to listen to it live. I just wanted to share a thought about using silence in transition. And I work in healthcare as a nurse. And one of the programs that we used to do at the institution where I work, we use that moment before you enter into a new patient's room or a different patient's room to just close your eyes and have a moment of silence so that you can leave the experiences that you've had previous and go in with a new sort of mindset. And I was listening to the woman talking about her driveway moment of silence, and thinking that that's that place of I've arrived, I'm going to have a piece of silence to acknowledge where I am now and move on.
Liz, thank you. We also have Brian, who also works in healthcare, I believe. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Great episode, and I really appreciate this chance to speak. Yes, I did spend over 20 years as a registered nurse working in the emergency department. The stressors that I that came upon me were rather significant. I retired at 59, and a few months later, I had a heart attack, which I attribute to the stressors that came along with the job. I live alone. I live in the deep woods, been here for 2.5 years in what I would regard as silence. And I found some incredible benefits to it. I have been able to self-heal from the chronic stress, from the anxiety. I think one thing that we don't recognize in this society is that silence was the natural norm, and we're just inundated with not only auditory overload, but visual overload, and so on and so forth. And so I'm really looking forward to reading your book, Jane. I haven't read anything by you in the past, but I'm really looking forward to finding and reading your book. It's it can be a little bit anxiety provoking to enter this world. It's not social isolation. I can head out anytime I wish. It's sort of a learned behavior. So thanks again for making this episode possible, and I'll just listen on from here. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think silence, you know, noise isn't the only opposite of silence. I think distraction is also an opposite of silence. Silence has many things, I think, weighing on it in the modern age.
And what he said is what we were talking about earlier with light and dark as well.
Right.
I mean, so many things are different than how humans lived for so long.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, my previous book, Brilliant, was the way I think looking at the way society moved out of darkness into light. And this is almost looking at the way we've moved from silence into noise, in a way, the same trajectory.
Catherine on Facebook says, my husband and I have 5 children and a dog, 2 sets of twins. Yes, I crave silence, but I find that when it happens, I feel disoriented and I hear phantom cries.
That's, you know, it's interesting. I was speaking with a nun at a Trappistine monastery in Massachusetts, and she was saying that she noticed when the postulants, the young women, came into the monastery, that they were very uneasy to start with, and she really enjoyed watching them settle into the life, that it takes a long time to become accustomed to silence again once you've been in the world.
We'll go to Robin, who's calling from Brooklyn. Hi, Robin. Go ahead. Brooklyn, Maine.
Hi. I moved up to Maine about 4 years ago, and we first lived in Blue Hill down a long driveway, and it was so silent, me and my husband felt a little crazy looking out at the trees, and it just seemed like the silence was overbearing. But a few months later, I went back to visit family in New Jersey, and then as soon as I got into a car, the traffic, it was just blaring in my ears, and hearing my family talk was hard. I was craving silence again. We ended up moving over to Brooklyn, which is a little more of a community in Maine, without a long driveway. So we could kind of go half and half. But yes, I love the silence, and I don't think I could live in a place without it now after 4 years.
You've acclimated and more.
Yes, acclimated and more, yeah.
I don't think that's an uncommon experience, that you know, the discomfort at first becomes something that ends up being essential.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I don't think unusual for people from Maine who have moved here from somewhere else, but right. The same could probably be true for people who live in Montana who've moved there from somewhere
right.
busier,
right.
you know,
right.
people who have chosen a quieter life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Robin, thanks so much for calling in and sharing. We'll go to Regina, who's calling from Castine. Hi, Regina, go ahead.
Hi, Jane and Jennifer. I was an Episcopal nun for many years, and I experienced all different kinds of silence. And my other point of entry in the discussion is that I'm also a scholar for the religious life. And in my studies of the Cistercians, I came to understand that their understanding of silence was very different. It wasn't just that you don't talk or you don't make noises. A monastery, especially one that is in the process of being built, and all the agriculture around them and all the offices around them, it was not really a silent place. So they had to figure out a different way of looking at silence and experiencing it. A visual silence was huge with the Cistercians, the way that they responded to each other, not drawing attention to each other, not drawing attention to themselves. So there was a deeper understanding of silence than just lack of talking, lack of noise.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, they were a community that worked together. They communicated all the time. And silence was a space of seeking. Silence was a space of seeking communion with God, right?
So a place of humility.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Regina, thanks so much for calling in and sharing. We've been talking a lot about monks, but I want to bring in the idea of nuns and other women and their experience with silence, and silence not only by choice, but what is expected of women over the centuries. This is something right. you write about in your book.
Right, because both in the monastery and the penitentiary, the experience of women was historically very different from the experience of men. Even before the age of the penitentiary, women, there were special punishments for women who gossiped. They could be bridled. An iron cage could be put on their head and a bit put in their mouth to keep them from talking if they were found to be talking too much or gossiping or talking in too loud a voice. And that that extended into the penitentiary period, where the penitentiary at first had no place for women, because at the time it was thought that many fallen women couldn't find redemption. So they would have no need of the penitentiary. In the monastery, women's reasons in the Middle Ages for going into a monastery were often different from men. They often had no choice, and the women were often in places that were poorer than men and were more restrictive than men. Even the Cistercian nuns, their life was much more restricted than that of the Cistercian monks.
An email from Mayor. As a minister, at times I speak on the question, what are we afraid of in silence? I think our avoidance is not just a cultural overload of noise, but something primal we are getting farther and farther from.
Yes. I think that's what the Cistercian silence is about, you know, returning to that idea of what is in silence. They were looking to find God in the silence and communicate with God in the silence.
And the tweet, wonder if Jane covers technology at all in her social history of silence, noise-canceling headphones, etc. And you don't really talk about noise-canceling headphones, but
no.
But it's another manifestation of how people are seeking silence.
Right.
We're going to go to Jack in Gardner. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Good to hear you again. I just got back after Christmas for a 3-day silent retreat in an Episcopal monastery in West Newbury. It was unbelievable. It was like a golden experience. Meals in silence, meditation, teachings about it. Came back home and tried, and I found myself dropping the silence and flipping back and forth between CNN and Fox News, and it's been horrible. So I was just speaking about this with some friends the other day, and I had to get back on the beam and go back to meditation and some quiet time with my wife, which we've just begun doing. Did it this morning just before we turned on the news about Roger Stone and all that. And the quiet just is so settling. And as to why we're afraid of quiet, I think in the preceding conversation, I think sometimes it's in the quietness that things are revealed to us about our own personality and life, our strengths and weaknesses, and we have to deal with them. Otherwise, we're just too busy to pay attention. So that's my thought.
There's no place to hide in the silence.
There is no place to hide.
Yeah. I was thinking, though, Jack, there's an in-between between complete silence and cable news, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's kind of the two ends of the spectrum. Yeah. No, but thanks so much for calling in and sharing your experience. I think, let's see, we'll go to Barbara on Facebook. She says, as a musician, people sometimes, I think, I listen to music all the time. Not true. I often like a relatively quiet house or a quiet drive in the car. Silence is also an important element in music.
It is, and she makes a wonderful point in that I think silence helps accentuate music. It's part of music. There are silences within music. That's also true for conversation. You know, speech and silence belong together. I think a true conversation has to have spaces for silence in which people can often think of how to truly respond to one another, too.
And an email from Myron. For me, silence is an impossibility and effectively an annoyance. That's because I suffer from tinnitus. And therefore, when confronted with silence, all I can hear is incessant ringing in my ears. So the only choice for me is to select the noise that I want to drown out the ringing with. That is usually main public quiet music or the sounds of the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Myron, thanks for your email. And it is going to be our last email or call today. We're out of time. And thank you so much, Jane, for coming in. Congratulations on your new book. Her new book is Silence, A Social History of One of the Least Understood Elements of Our Lives. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can hear this program again tonight at 8. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandreau. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.